Welcome to Behind the Headlines. This show is a roundup of local news from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard all over the state on Utah Public Radio, live every Friday morning. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, workers protest after 287 test positive for COVID-19 at a Utah meatpacking plant. Former Utah Governor John Huntsman Jr. says that he has tested positive for coronavirus after receiving a false negative test earlier this week. And family members of inmates who died in the Salt Lake County Jail seek changes at the facility. On the phone with me for this conversation are Salt Lake Tribune reporter Taylor Stevens. Thanks for joining, Taylor. Good morning.
Good morning.
And also reporter Jessica Miller. Welcome and thanks for being here, Jessica.
Good morning.
Good morning. A bit later in the show, we will turn to a conversation with Tribune reporter Andy Larson as well about the asymptomatic spread of coronavirus. And for right now, though, listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments. The number to call is 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. You can also always tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Well, Utah is in the midst of a coronavirus spike, and some of that has been attributed to the reopening of the economy across the state. State epidemiologist Dr. Angela Dunn said that they expected some increase in cases from the relaxation of restrictions. So there is that, but there is also the fact that for some so-called essential workers, the conditions on the job can lead to their getting this virus. And that was the case for a sizable number of workers at a meatpacking plant in Cache County, where what is possibly Utah's largest single outbreak of coronavirus has occurred. And Jessica Miller, you were at a protest this week that had to do with this. Maybe you can first start by telling us about those numbers, 287 people, and is it the largest single outbreak that we've seen so far?
Right. So, yeah, there's been 287 workers who tested positive for the virus that the health department is aware of. That number could be higher if they sought testing not with the health department. But it does seem this is possibly the single biggest outbreak that Utah has seen. And so this last week we saw it was a pretty small protest, especially in comparison to all the other protests that have been going on in Utah in these last couple of weeks. But there were workers who basically showed up. They got to the parking lot of work, basically, and went on strike. They didn't go into work. And so they decided to kind of keep that protest going, not just by not going to work, but going to Logan, going to the main area of town with signs protesting, asking that JBS close this beef plant, at least just to clean it, because there's just been so many people, so many of the workers there have tested positive.
Can you tell us about this plant, JBS? JBS is an international meat processing company, and so this isn't the only spot. Well, not so, but this is not the only, you know, JBS facility that has seen a coronavirus outbreak, right?
Correct. Yeah. So it's a company that's based in Colorado, and they've had significant outbreaks at plants there. I think there's actually been a few deaths associated with the plant in Colorado. There's been outbreaks in Kentucky and Minnesota, Wisconsin. There was actually a facility in Brazil where a labor judge had ordered that plant be shut down because 60% of all of the infections in that municipality had come from that facility. So it's been an issue not just at the plant in Utah, but at these JBS facilities around the country and in other parts of the world as well.
You wrote that states... state leaders, that is, that they can't step in and shut these facilities down in the face of an outbreak like the one that is happening there. Why is that the case? Why can't they do that?
I believe it's because the president has determined that these facilities are essential. And so, you know, we still need meat and everything, even during this outbreak. And so it's been deemed an essential business. And so that's kind of blocked state or local health departments from shutting it down. The U.S. Department of Agriculture could shut down the plant if it wanted to. It's given no indication yet that it would do so.
Okay. This is the largest, you know, pandemic or the largest outbreak during this pandemic here in Utah that we've seen so far. What does JBS, the company, say that it is doing? Is it still open, I understand?
Yes, it is still open. It's working at a limited capacity. Hang on just one second. So, yeah, it's still open. It's still operating. They said that they've been, you know, paying people if they've tested positive. You know, they've been going home But it does seem like that there's been, we've heard from a lot of employees that said that they were still asked to work while their tests were pending, or if they were ill, they were told to finish their shifts before they could go get tested. So it seems like what the workers have been reporting is different than what the corporation has been telling us that they've been doing.
And some of the comments from the workers that you spoke to are, you know, they're pretty dire. Some of them look at this as very much a life and death situation. Can you talk about how the workers are viewing, first, who are these workers? I know that a number of them, for them, they feel like if they don't go back to work, they're going to lose their job. Can you just tell us who they are and how they're seeing this?
A lot of them are Latinx. They are, you know, they're Hispanic. A lot of them speak Spanish. A lot of the people that we spoke with, we had a reporter who's fluent in Spanish and was able to talk with them. And, you know, a lot of them, their families work there. Their husband works there along with them, or, you know, it's a father and a daughter. Like, their families are working at this plant. And there's definitely been a lot of concern that the whole of families are getting infected, or there was like one woman that we talked to whose son has Down syndrome and they've tested negative, but she's worried that she could get coronavirus from continuing to work and that could cause complications for her son. We talked with another woman who was reported feeling ill, and her supervisor wouldn't let her leave, even though she was, you know, presenting those classic symptoms of coronavirus. And she left the plant crying that day because she was just so worried that she might have infected her coworkers, but she couldn't take work off to get tested. Her supervisor wouldn't allow that.
Hmm. Obviously, this isn't a job that you can, you know, you can do remotely, processing meat.
Right.
And then if you do get sick and you have to stay home for most of us, there are unemployment benefits. There are some you know, new programs that have been launched as well to try and help people who have lost work as a result of the coronavirus. But then, you know, you might worry about not getting rehired. There are also, as you said, as many of these people are immigrants, there may be language barriers to accessing benefits. And then for, you know, undocumented workers in the United States, it's you don't necessarily have access to a lot of these benefits, including unemployment. So there was a one-day protest on Tuesday. Has anything happened since then, Jessica?
It's definitely a situation that we've been monitoring. I mean, the county itself has actually asked to be moved to a lower risk level, to like the green level with coronavirus restrictions, which is interesting that the leaders have been doing this despite the outbreak there, that they think that they're ready to reopen everything, that it's affecting businesses there. The governor hasn't weighed in on that yet, so we'll see how that goes. But that's kind of been the latest so far. But the plant's still operating as it has been in these last few weeks.
Okay. Anything else to add to the story, Jessica, before we move on to other news from this past week in Utah's headlines?
No, I think we covered it.
All right. It's just the story of the protest, and then the initial story about the outbreak are a really interesting read. You can find them at sltrib.com. We are now going to move on to other stories. Taylor Stevens, a reporter with Salt Lake Tribune as well, we're going to bring you in, and we're going to stick with coronavirus for a little bit longer. Going from the meatpacking industry to another walk of life, I guess you could say a prominent politician, a gubernatorial candidate, says that he has tested positive for the virus after initially getting a false positive or a false negative, test result. Tell us the story, Taylor. Who are we talking about here?
Yeah, so former Governor John Huntsman, who I will disclose is the brother of the chairman of the Salt Lake Tribune's nonprofit board of directors, but he announced late last week that a campaign staffer had tested positive for the coronavirus and that he was going into quarantine as he awaited the results of his test. Early this week, he and his team notified everyone that he had tested negative for the coronavirus. But the next day, he put on Twitter that diagnosis was actually wrong, that it had been based on a test he'd taken previously for the coronavirus. Apparently, his test that he had taken this time around was contaminated. Somebody went into the system, confused the dates, and called him and told him incorrectly that he had tested negative. And so he had to go take a third test. And that one, you know, the next day he received notification that he had indeed tested positive for the coronavirus. A bit of a winding road for that diagnosis.
A winding road, but then he does find out that he has a positive test result. Am I right that several people around him have tested positive as well, meaning several other staffers, or is it just him so far, other than the first person that you mentioned?
So ultimately, six members of his staff have tested positive at this point, and he is also, he's been isolating with family. I believe there are about 10 people under the roof, his daughters, their children, and so they have all been tested. Some of them, as of earlier this week, were still waiting for their results. Abby Huntsman, his daughter, who is running campaign spokeswoman right now, running that side of operations, she tested negative, but now that her father has tested positive, she actually went back and got another test that she was awaiting results on. So, you know, it's not only the campaign, but also his, you know, many members of his family who are still awaiting results.
Taylor, he has been at some campaign events recently, you know, shaking hands with people and being in close proximity. And, you know, there's photos of him and he's not wearing a mask. What about for those people who were at those events in his close proximity? Is there advice for them?
Yeah, as you mentioned, so this was a few hours before the campaign heard that this staffer had been tested, let alone tested positive. So in Logan, he did attend a campaign event outdoors. As you mentioned, pictures show he shook hands with multiple people. Nobody seemed to be wearing a mask. You know, the campaign says they weren't aware, just kind of going on campaign events as planned. The campaign says it's made an effort to reach out to anyone who may be at risk of exposure, although, you know, they don't necessarily have contact information for everyone who was at the event. The Salt Lake County Health Department, though, says that as a general rule of thumb to assess coronavirus risk, if someone was with the person for greater than 10 minutes and standing within 6 feet of them, that would be considered an exposure, and those people should monitor their symptoms and take a test if they start to exhibit any symptoms.
Okay. And so the former governor and ambassador, he's self-quarantining now. The governor's race, though, is continuing. Is this having an impact on the kinds of things that would normally be happening for the governor's race?
You know, it's been a really strange campaign cycle because, in a way, candidates have already been forced to do a lot from home. However, you never want to have a diagnosis like this, you know, 20 days before the ballots drop, or excuse me, the ballots have already dropped, but 20 days before the election results come in. And so he says that he's still campaigning from home and that he doesn't see this as a setback. I think, you know, you could see the challenges of trying to campaign not only from home, but with a virus we've heard some people have had, you know, bad symptoms of. But he says, and his daughter says, that this has sort of energized him even more, just seeing the process and getting an understanding of what people are going through right now, and that he is more energized than ever to, you know, want to improve the process and make things better for Utahns.
Okay, that is Salt Lake Tribune reporter Taylor Stevens talking about John Huntsman Jr.'s diagnosis with coronavirus. There's one more piece of coronavirus news that I want to get to, if we have time, a little bit later on the show. Right now, though, we are going to take a quick break, and then we will turn to some reporting about jail deaths from Jessica Miller. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Jessica Miller and Taylor Stevens. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and we invite you to join us with your questions and comments. The number to call is 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Well, Jessica Miller, earlier in the week, you reported on the fact that in the last several years, Neglect or substandard care in the Salt Lake County Jail has led to inmate deaths or serious injuries that family members say could have been prevented. And these family members want to see some changes made inside the facility. First off, you looked at data from a 5-year period. Tell us about the numbers. How many people died inside this jail? And you know, there's probably no broad response to this, but how did they die?
So there's data that shows that there's been 31 deaths in Salt Lake County Jail in a period, the 5 years before January 2019. And this was information that came to light as part of a lawsuit that was filed after one of these deaths. So they've... You know, it's always a varying thing. There's medical issues. There's people who die by suicide. One of the women that I profiled in the story, she didn't die, but she was pregnant and she had asked for medical help. And by the time she received it, her baby had died. So there's not a specific, a certain way that people are dying most often. But the common complaint that these families have is that inmates are asking for help. They're asking for medical care, and they're not being believed or not being taken seriously by the workers there. They're either written off as, you know, coming off of drugs when they were booked in, if they had reported that they use illegal drugs, or that they were just faking it to try to get out of jail or to try to get, you know, painkillers or whatever it might be. So the common complaint just is that medical care, that the inmates are complaining of medical issues and it's not being taken seriously.
You highlight a few cases of people who died and you mentioned a couple of them there. I'm wondering if you could tell us, you know, one or two of those stories. For example, the story of Lisa Ostler, who was basically, one of these people who was begging for help the night before she died. Can you tell us her story?
Yeah, Lisa Ostler had been in the jail in 2016. She had Crohn's disease and had been prescribed an over-the-counter acid blocker. She wasn't given that medication, and an ulcer had perforated her bowels, and she was dying this very slow and painful death. She had asked for help. She's pressing her intercom button in her cell, you know, a dozen times or more, telling the jailer that she was in pain. But the nurse had concluded that she was withdrawing from heroin. And so they kind of just let her be in jail, kind of even told her, you know, I bet you it feels like you're going to die, but you'll get better in a few days. It wasn't drug withdrawal. She was dying from peritonitis. And so finally after pleading in pain for a few days, she was found unconscious and they took her to get medical care. But by that time it was too late and she had passed away. And that was a similar vein with some of these other stories that I profiled. Is, you know, a woman begged for help for weeks because she was bleeding and didn't get medical help and her baby died. There was another woman who complained that she was in pain, and similarly, they felt that she had been withdrawing or just complaining, but she was having a stroke and she died of that stroke. So that's been a pretty common theme in these stories that I've heard is the lack of medical care, the complaints aren't being taken seriously.
Jessica, there are a number of these stories, and I want to jump forward though to calls for a change in procedure and in culture at the jail. Some of that is coming from a former Salt Lake City mayor, attorney Rocky Anderson. Can you talk about what he's asking for, and then we can get to the jail's response, the county's response, I guess.
Right. So Rocky Anderson is an attorney. He was the mayor at one point. He's an attorney now, and he represented Lisa Ostler's family in their case. And so a lot of this information that he kind of passed on to us that was in the story was information that they received as he was litigating this lawsuit. They ended up settling that case for $950,000 that mostly went to Lisa's children. But the frustration that they had was, you know, they would like to talk about changes in the jail. They want to talk about how they can get better medical care, how, you know, charting can change, how there needs to be a culture change where inmates are taken seriously. And they say that when they went to negotiate the lawsuit, that was kind of put off the table and all the county would discuss was how much money they would settle for. And so even though now that lawsuit's over, they're still kind of pushing for this reform, for this change, and they want elected leaders to do an investigation and audit of the jail.
Well, what do elected leaders say about that? I mean, the county council, the county mayor, is there a response from them?
Rocky said that there hasn't been much of a response so far. I mean, obviously the jail officials did respond when they received this letter, and you know, reached out to them and told them I was working on a story about this. So they did respond for my article, and they basically said that they worked to provide better medical care for the inmates since Rosie Rivera became the sheriff 3 years ago, that their medical charting system is better. They've altered how they treat people who are experiencing drug withdrawals. They have hydration stations now, and they've started using medicine, methadone, things like that to help inmates who are coming off of drugs if they are experiencing withdrawals.
There are, I just going back to the, I don't know if this is pre that change in policy or change in leadership, I guess. But you spoke with a former deputy at the jail who talked about a kind of troubling culture among the deputies who work there. Can you talk about the stories that she told you?
Right. Yeah. She, you know, her biggest gripe, I guess, with her time at the jail was, you know, it seemed like those deputies who are very callous or tough or, you know, used more force maybe or more forceful in what they interacted with inmates, they were the ones who, you know, were mentored or given promotional opportunities. And then there were those who showed compassion towards inmates, and they kind of had to do so in secret or, you know, kind of down low because they would be ridiculed by their fellow workers. And, you know, for her, she thinks that, you know, it takes all different personalities to run a jail efficiently. Sometimes you need someone who's callous and tough, and sometimes you need somebody who is very caring and compassionate. And she doesn't feel like that compassionate nature was valued at the jail or taken seriously, that it was more of those who were, you know, the tough, hard ones that were praised or promoted.
Hmm. I mean, the families that are you know, that have had loved ones die inside of the Salt Lake County Jail, talk about their family members basically losing their humanity when they go inside. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you want to highlight any of the other stories here, Jessica. We probably do have to turn to other news soon. What else are we missing from this story?
I mean, I think that one of the biggest takeaways that I had after talking with all of these different people, you know, they obviously don't know each other, but they all were just so frustrated by not just a system that they say kind of dehumanized their family members, that they weren't treated, you know, as people in the jail, but even now as they're pushing for change, the general public doesn't seem, they kind of feel like it's the same attitude, that the public doesn't see them as real people, that they were just inmates, that they weren't, you know, that they weren't all of these things that people are, grandmas and creative people who made artwork and loved their kids and all of these things like that. And so I think that really, that was really impactful to hear how frustrated each of them were, because they don't feel like the system will change or that they're being taken seriously.
Okay. Yeah, Jessica Miller, some really important and tough reporting from you, and thanks very much for doing it. I'm going to remind listeners that you can join this conversation with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to @KCPW. Before we go to another break, Taylor Stevens, I want to ask you about some reporting that you did this week on the push for police reform and, in some instances, for reallocating funding away from the police, changes that activists have been pushing for some time, but that are gaining steam in the wake of the all of the protests that we've seen sparked by the death of George Floyd in police custody in Minneapolis. Let's start at the state level, Taylor. Utah Governor Gary Herbert making a policy change for state law enforcement. What is that?
Yeah, so he announced this yesterday on the heels of a meeting last week with the Martin Luther King Commission. And what the policy change is that state officers will no longer be allowed to use chokeholds. So he has banned chokeholds from, you know, law enforcement agencies, and he's urging others around the state to institute a similar ban. He says that no state public safety or correction officer is permitted to use chokeholds or restraints that pressure the neck or the spine.
And that came after the Salt Lake City Council did something similar, or Salt Lake City Police did something similar. Can you tell us what they did?
Yeah, so they have also banned chokeholds and the use of tear gas. However, Salt Lake City Police said that those were tactics that they weren't using, and that's just a codification of that policy.
Okay. Meanwhile, speaking of the Salt Lake City Council, they have been hearing calls to defund the police. And I know this is a topic of a lot of conversation nationally, but maybe you could lay out for us what that means, Taylor, and how the council is responding to those calls. This is something else that you wrote about this week.
Yeah, I think a lot of people hear the phrase defund the police and think that means abolish the police. That's actually not what most advocates are calling for. There are, to be sure, some people who would like to see the police abolished altogether, but the main thread that council members are hearing from the public right now is to reallocate funding, so to defund, take some money away from the police budget and put it towards other social services, so affordable housing, mental health, transportation, other services that benefit people and, in a certain sense, really some services that could keep people from needing policing in the first place. So if you have a place to live, then you don't become homeless and then you don't have those run-ins with the police that we know people experiencing homelessness are more likely to have. So that's really what they're asking for. And they want to see $30 million taken from the city's police department budget. Council members say that's pretty unlikely to happen, but they are looking at maybe, having a little bit more oversight of some of the funds that the police department has in its $84 million budget.
I mean, the question is, would that impact staffing levels or would it, at the police department, or would it impact equipment? How would that $30 million cut happen? But again, as you say, the council says that's unlikely. Are any council members sort of on board with the idea?
Yeah, so Salt Lake City Councilwoman Amy Fowler, who is a public defender and a criminal defense attorney, she is really on board with this idea of reallocating resources. She hasn't committed to a particular dollar figure, so I don't know that she is completely on board with that $30 million. A lot of council members recognize that this is something that might need to happen gradually, but she does say that moving funds to social services is her number one priority for that same reason I talked about a minute ago, which is that, there needs to be sort of this effort to address the underlying causes that lead people to have interactions with the police. This also could, take some of the pressure off of police to fill so many roles like they have been doing since the recession, when they've taken on more, social work, family work, doing more of the addiction, dealing with so many problems, that funding some of those other programs on the back end could make it so that people never have to have these interactions with police, therefore, reducing the police workload as you're reducing their budget.
I guess it sounds kind of like the conversation about reallocating funding is, or at least here in Salt Lake City, is maybe getting tabled or delayed a bit. I'm just wondering if, you probably can't predict, Taylor, but, right now there's a lot of pressure for reform to happen, a lot of focus from the public on this. I'm wondering if activists are worried that if it doesn't happen now, it's never going to happen.
Yeah, I think there's always that sense, right, that there's a movement right now and there's a lot of attention, and what if that attention goes away? On the one hand, this is a really good time to be having this conversation because the council is actively working on its budget. The budget hasn't been finalized. On the other hand, there's only a few weeks until the council has to approve its budget by state law by the end of this month. And so that is sort of a big shift to accomplish in just a few weeks. We know that government notoriously moves slowly. So it's both a good time and a challenging time. But, I think there's definitely fear that if there's not enough momentum now, then there might never be.
Okay, Taylor Stevens, anything to add on this story before we move on to another break and more from this past week in Utah news?
Yeah, I think I'll just mention my colleague Leah Larson has been covering the council meetings where just dozens upon dozens of people have been showing up to call for this, almost all of them asking for reallocating funds. The council had another meeting Thursday. So they had a Tuesday meeting and a Thursday meeting. And I think that they're expected to make some moves maybe sometime next week. So stay tuned for that.
Okay, we will stay tuned. In the meantime, Taylor Stevens, thanks very much for your reporting. We're going to head to a quick break. This is Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in 1 minute.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Jessica Miller and Taylor Stevens. It is our Friday morning local news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. You can join with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. Before the break, we were talking about police reform efforts, and we actually have a caller with a question that I'm not certain either of my reporters will be able to address, but this is Anna from Helper. And Anna, what's your question or comment?
I just wanted to make comment about the Price police chief, who before becoming police chief made some Facebook posts that were highly racist, and including using the N-word multiple times. And I know that it's controversial, police reform, but someone who is using such language openly seems like maybe they shouldn't be in charge of the whole police department.
Okay. Anna, thank you for the comment. I'm going to just address that to our reporters, who I don't know if either of them have followed this at all, but Taylor or Jessica, are you aware of this story? Neither of them are there.
I'm not familiar with it.
No, I'm not.
Okay, just checking. Anna, thank you for the comment. Maybe it's something for us to dig into further, and we appreciate it. I'm gonna let you go, but I really appreciate your joining us for the show this morning. Again, listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. And sorry, Anna, that we weren't able to, you know, have much more to say about that. We were talking about coronavirus and the coronavirus outbreak at a meat processing plant earlier on the show, and also about John Huntsman Jr.'s diagnosis. I want to turn now to a conversation about how this pandemic is affecting homeless services providers. And Taylor Stevens, data from a survey shows that some of the core providers of services for Salt Lake County's homeless population are seeing some big impacts, and some of those impacts could be long-lasting. Can you give us a lay of the land on how coronavirus is impacting homeless services provision?
Yeah, definitely. And coronavirus has really hit the homeless service providers hard because, as we've talked about on this show before, people experiencing homelessness are more prone to the coronavirus, more likely to have negative effects as a result of the coronavirus. But like other businesses, the homeless service providers have been struggling to adjust to the coronavirus, the social distancing measures. This new survey that was presented at the Salt Lake Valley Coalition to End Homelessness meeting this week shows that about 16% of organizations have reduced their services to this population during the pandemic. 2% say they've temporarily shut down. There are also organizations that are concerned about their survivability, whether they'll be around, post-pandemic. So a third said that the virus has threatened their continued operations somewhat, while 14% indicated that was true to a great extent. So as the economy has struggled, so have these nonprofit organizations that provide services to some of the most vulnerable people in our community, not only, you know, just on the day-to-day, but also most vulnerable to the coronavirus.
Haven't there, Taylor, been... You talk about people who are in shelter and then those who are unsheltered. Haven't there been outbreaks at a homeless resource center, at least one of the homeless resource centers? Or maybe a better question is how are people who are either sheltered or unsheltered and are homeless, how are they experiencing this pandemic?
Yeah, so we did see an outbreak in the Men's Resource Center, the 300-bed Men's Resource Center in South Salt Lake, and the amount of people who tested positive there was just, you know, astronomical. And if you think about a homeless shelter, people in tight quarters, people on the streets, you know, they don't have access to as many hygiene facilities. They may have a harder time washing hands. They also can be in close quarters. So there has been a big focus on testing among this population. So to date, About 222 members of the homeless population have tested positive for the coronavirus. Just to put that in perspective, that's 3.6% of all positives in Salt Lake County. However, and this is kind of speaking to that vulnerability they have for worse results of, you know, having the coronavirus. All of the homeless population make up 7.1% of the total number of people who have been hospitalized. And then I'll just mention that 218 of those cases are considered recovered, meaning only 4 cases are active right now in the homeless population. So that does bode well right now.
And that's in shelters. What about people who are, unsheltered, who aren't on? Actually, before we go there, can I ask, you know, it's warmer weather and I know that that has an impact, but at what capacity are the shelters operating? Can you answer that, Taylor? Are they filled? Are they, is there space?
You know, I haven't checked in on the capacity numbers for a few days. I know that in the summer months, typically what we see is that people are more likely to camp because, you know, it's not as cold outside. And so there are people who choose just would rather camp. But that's a good reminder to check back in on those. And just to clarify really quick on your other point, so that 222, as I understand it, is the entire homeless population, both sheltered and unsheltered. However, it's obviously easier to test those in shelter than those who are unsheltered. So probably a bigger percentage of that 222 number are in the shelters.
Right, because of the amount of testing that's been done. What else do we need to know on this story before we wrap up and turn to our underplayed stories of the week, Taylor?
I think another challenge that the service providers are facing is the loss of volunteers as a result of the coronavirus. You know, a lot of people have been staying home trying to do their best to social distance, but that's kind of a circumstance that I don't know that a lot of people have thought about, that the volunteer pool has dried up a lot, and that's also impacting ability to offer these services to our homeless community.
Well, it sounds almost similar to polling locations in Georgia where, you know, nobody showed up. None of the volunteers who normally showed up could show up because of the pandemic and the impact on voting, which is an entirely different story. But Taylor Stevens, thank you very much for your reporting on this. We need to turn now to our final segment of the show, the Underplayed Stories of the Week, to save time for a recorded feature with Andy Larson about asymptomatic spread of coronavirus. Jessica Miller, we haven't heard from you in a little while. Do you have a pick for Underplayed Story of the Week?
Yeah, I had kind of an interesting story that published this morning about David Levitt, who's the Republican candidate for attorney general. He's also the Utah County attorney, but apparently he's been moonlighting in this part-time job loading luggage on planes for Delta for the flight benefits. He's been able to fly across the world with his family because he works this part-time job on evenings and Saturdays. It was a disclosure that kind of came to public light because he had to disclose it on his campaign forms as he's running for attorney general.
Okay, I'll check that out at SLTrib. I had that had slipped by me. Thanks for that choice, Jessica Miller. Taylor Stevens, your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week.
Yeah, I want to highlight a story my colleague Brian Mathley did about a 6-week trial that was screening wastewater for the coronavirus. Apparently, this pilot study concluded that it can actually help in early detection to screen the wastewater. It can help in early detection of local outbreaks. So that big outbreak in Cache County, the sewage actually detected that. So that's something that it sounds like they'll be scaling up and more details in, at sltrib.com.
Okay, check that out. Check that out. That is at sltrib.com. For my part, I guess I'll go with a story about the fact that a number of farmers markets across the state of Utah are going to be opening up despite the coronavirus. There will be a number of restrictions on what happens at farmers markets, not the same sort of festival atmosphere you may have expected in years past. There's a story by Kathy Stevenson at the Salt Lake Tribune about this. And you can find that as well as everything else that we've been talking about in the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune or at sltrib.com. Jessica Miller and Taylor Stevens, both reporters with the Salt Lake Tribune, thank you very much for joining us on Behind the Headlines today.
Thank you.
We will turn now to a conversation that I had with Tribune reporter Andy Larson. Andy has been covering the science behind asymptomatic spread of coronavirus. Take a listen. Salt Lake Tribune reporter Andy Larson, thanks very much for making time.
Thanks again for having me. This week you wrote about a headline that has gotten some play, and the headline read, "Asymptomatic spread of coronavirus is very rare," WHO says. Asymptomatic spread refers to people who have the virus, who don't have symptoms, and so likely don't know they have the virus, but they infect other people. And I think there's a sort of common understanding of what asymptomatic means, and then there's the more precise definition that you describe in your article. For that common definition, you know, us lay people, those of us who aren't epidemiologists or researchers, we often lump in another group, which is pre-symptomatic people. So before we get to the WHO statement or the statement by this one doctor and how it's been interpreted, can you just explain the difference, Andy, between asymptomatic people and pre-symptomatic people?
Yeah, so there's this kind of medical difference that the medical professionals are kind of sticking to, where you've got asymptomatic people who are people who contract COVID-19, the coronavirus, but don't ever show any symptoms during the entire course of their treatment, of the disease. So that's, they don't have a runny nose, they don't have a fever, they don't have a sore throat, they don't have a cough, they don't have anything, okay? Then there are the pre-symptomatic people, people who test positive but don't have symptoms yet. You know, those are people who have been infected and will get symptoms at some point down the road, but, you know, don't at this point. And so I think there's this kind of medical difference how we talk about those two groups, and when in reality, to you or I or anyone else on the street, those people could be the same, right? We don't know if someone's going to have symptoms later on.
Right. The headline again is this idea that asymptomatic spread of coronavirus is very rare, WHO says. Why would it matter if people who didn't have symptoms weren't actually spreading the virus, Andy?
You know, those are the kinds of people that we tend to miss most when we're testing, right? You know, people who never show any symptoms whatsoever. If those people were spreading the disease in large numbers, our contact tracing would be really, really difficult, right? Like, it would just be really, if those people were transmitting the disease in big ways, we would just be missing huge swaths of cases that we wouldn't be able to kind of go back and count.
Yeah. And if it was that they, you know, that they aren't, you know, the way that this headline kind of points out, they aren't actually spreading the virus, what would our strategy there be? I mean, wouldn't that kind of change the way that we look at coronavirus in general?
Yeah, you know, if that's true, and you know, again, we have to make that asymptomatic versus pre-symptomatic thing. If even pre-symptomatic people weren't spreading the disease at all, then we could theoretically just put all of our efforts into stopping symptomatic people from kind of going about everyday life and infecting others, right?
Right. So you're going to get on a plane, you know, they take your temperature, they say you're good to go, or they say, oh, you've got symptoms, you need to turn around and get out of here.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, kind of that's an approach that a number of businesses have tried to take as well.
Okay, well then what do we know, Andy, about people who aren't showing symptoms and to what extent they actually do spread the virus? And I think in this instance, we have to kind of lump together pre-symptomatic and asymptomatic people. You know, yeah, what do we know about that?
Yeah, you know, so the truly asymptomatic people, it's true what the WHO said. It does seem like they don't spread the virus very well. What you have is mildly symptomatic people spread it actually very well. So people who have runny noses, kind of sore throats, maybe the occasional cough, but don't really feel sick. They probably think it's allergies or something, right? Those people really do spread the virus quite well. And then also pre-symptomatic people, people who don't experience any symptoms but will in a couple of days, also tend to spread the virus at least relatively okay. And, you know, there are a bunch of different studies on it. I looked at three that showed that anywhere between 6% and 44% of current coronavirus cases are from pre-symptomatic spread.
And it's interesting. I mean, you talk about some of the problems in the data in general on all of this. One is that a lot of people who aren't showing symptoms are going to be left out of the numbers in general just because we aren't testing them, right? I mean,
right. Yeah. I mean, those are exactly the people who have been told not to get tested during large parts of this pandemic, right?
Another problem that you point out with all of this is that, you know, even if it were the case that asymptomatic spread, you know, was actually very rare, that people who didn't have symptoms weren't really spreading it, trying to test people for symptoms might actually not be all that easy either because of the range of symptoms and, you know, what people are willing to report. And also, not everybody experiences the same symptoms equally.
Yeah, It's a complicated situation, right? And I think Salt Lake County has really good data on this, actually, to break down of all their positive cases. They ask them what symptoms they currently have. And so you get, you know, you look at the number of people who have a cough, or the number of people who have muscle aches or a headache or a fever or chills. And it's really interesting, you know, so 60% of people do have a cough. That's a majority, but that does mean that 40% of people aren't coughing at all, right? And fever, this is the temperature check idea that has taken hold in some places. Well, only 36% of people who tested positive had a fever in Salt Lake County. And that's despite 41% of them feeling feverish. So it's kind of interesting that even if you feel feverish and are testing positive for the coronavirus, you may not show up as someone who has a high temperature. So all of the remaining symptoms are under 50%, you know, or a minority of COVID-19 positive cases have those symptoms. And so that's something that we have to be aware of. I go back to the Antarctica cruise ship, and I know that the cruise ship thing is overplayed and not really people's usual everyday scenarios, but I thought it was really interesting because they took every precaution you could in terms of preventing people with COVID-19 from coming onto this boat. It was a boat of about 250 people. They didn't allow anyone from high-risk coronavirus countries. They had two doctors on board to kind of scan people for symptoms, including taking temperature checks. And it turned out after a couple of weeks, over 59% of people on that ship ended testing up positive for coronavirus, despite everyone being healthy and everyone being safe, quote unquote, you know, before boarding. So it just kind of shows that maybe that approach of dealing with only symptomatic people isn't going to stop a large portion of the spread.
Andy, you know, how do we take all of this information about asymptomatic and pre-symptomatic spread and do something with it? I mean, we're also seeing this spike that's occurring right now across the United States, here in Utah as well. I guess, do you want to summarize the findings of this little portion, and then maybe we can zoom out for one quick second, Andy, and talk about where we are in this pandemic?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I think clearly the answer by this WHO doctor caused a lot of confusion and even chaos, really, in terms of how people think about this thing. And, you know, I think the overall takeaway is exactly that we can't just focus on symptomatic people. It's the non-sick that will have to take steps to protect themselves and their community. And so, you know, in terms of our policies, I think we have to continue to take those kinds of people into account when we're deciding what the right thing to do is.
Are we going to have this pandemic virus forever, Andy? I mean, is it just with us? Do you have a sense of that?
I don't think we're going to eradicate it, not for several years, certainly. The vaccine certainly will help when it comes, and I do believe that it will come, and even I'm pretty optimistic about that timeline. But it is something that even until then and even a little bit after that, as you know, we have slow vaccine adoption and not everyone is going to be taking the shot, people are going to have to change the way that they do things in some cases. You know, I think Dr. Anthony Fauci got a lot of criticism for saying, hey, maybe we shouldn't shake hands anymore, right? Like that may be a thing that we can do to stop the spread a little bit. And I understand why that's a scary concept for the future. But I think there's some other things we can do that can help, you know, whether it's designing buildings to have more ventilation so we don't have all these stuffy boxes of potential viral spread, or, you know, keeping those hand sanitizer stations that we put up everywhere. It's good practice with coronavirus or the flu or any of these other things. So, you know, I think we can take steps in our everyday lives to make this kind of pandemic less likely in the future and less severe, and be sensible and still get to enjoy the things we love, but maybe, you know, be smart about it.
Andy Larson is a Salt Lake Tribune reporter, normally a sports reporter, covering all things coronavirus for quite a while now, since early on in this pandemic.
Exactly 3 months, actually.
Exactly 3 months. Wow. Well, congratulations on the milestone. I don't think it's the right term, but you're doing a good job, and we really appreciate it. So, Andy Larson, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
And again, that's Salt Lake Tribune reporter Andy Larson. He's been covering the science of coronavirus for the Tribune. You can find his clear and useful columns about the pandemic at sltrib.com. Since we have just a little bit of time left on the show, I will promote a couple of other of KCBW programs that aired this week. This week's episode of Both Sides of the Aisle, our political debate show that features voices from the left, right, and center, focused on something that we talked a little bit about on this show today, defunding the police. They also talked about the former Defense Secretary Jim Mattis denouncing President Donald Trump, and about white supremacy and institutional racism. And our program In the Hive was one from the archives, an in-depth look at Black Lives Matter Utah and about conversations between reform activists and the police about changing how policing is done. You can find both of those programs and a host of others at kcpw.org. And that does it for Behind the Headlines, a co-production of the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Jesse Ellis is our operations director. Thanks, Jesse, very much for your help on the show. And thanks as well to Utah Public Radio's team in Logan for sending us around the state. I'm Roger McDonough. That is some loud music. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. Join us again on Behind the Headlines next Friday.